Writer Podcast.
All right. Thanks for downloading episode 7 of the Outrider Podcast. When we're done here, please swing by eunoiasolstice.com and take a look at some of the other stuff we're doing. If I were posting more frequently on my personal blog, I'd also send you to my own website, jquinnmalott.com. How's that for self-promotion? Anyway, maybe now that I'm talking to other writers on a regular basis, I'll have more to write about there. So, speaking of writers, today we've got my conversation with Kansas City's second-best writer, according to the best of Kansas City, at least, David Wayne Reed. Who beat him out for first place? Another David, David Sedaris. Now, I look at that and I think, man, what a cheap shot. I mean, best of Kansas City kind of implies that to be eligible, the person, place, or thing should be of Kansas City, meaning it's from Kansas City, not visiting. Sedaris is great, don't get me wrong, I love Sedaris. But he's technically from England right now, and even if you don't count that, he's officially from, what, New York via North Carolina? He visited Kansas City once and did an event. David Wayne Reed lives in Kansas City, he writes in Kansas City, and he performs in Kansas City. Voting Sedaris number one is kind of like making a list of the best of the 90s and putting something from 1985 at the top of the list because one week in 93 there was a blippy resurgence of interest or something. In other words, it doesn't count. And that means David Wayne Reed is actually the best writer in Kansas City. So there. David has been a columnist for the Liberty Press, Midwest Times in KC, and for KC Magazine. He's recently had a short piece called Taking Laps appear in the fall 2013 issue of Midwestern Gothic. He's written and directed two full-length plays, Mother Trucker and Mother Trucker 2 Ride On, as well as his one-man show, Jolly Rancher, which he is currently turning into a memoir. His list of writing credits for the stage is actually much longer, so please go visit him at davidwaynereed.blogspot.com. There's a list of his credits there and some video and audio clips of his performances. Oh, and we were roommates for a semester at K-State, and I think this conversation is a few years overdue. So let's get to David Wayne Reed.
Hello?
David.
Yes.
This is Jason.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
I'm not doing too bad. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm doing good. It's been a couple of rough weeks, man. I don't know. It just seems like a lot of people I know and are around me have had like really rough kind of transitional times happening to them in the last couple of weeks. So I don't know. You ever feel that? Like when you think that, like what the hell is going on? Is this like a Mercury retrograde? Even though someone told me that that was not the case, but it's just kind of crazy. I'm looking forward to a new week. Yeah.
Actually, no. I've fallen so far out of touch with people lately, which is part of the reason I'm doing this podcast. And I've been in kind of a vacuum for a couple of years. So I'm reaching out and talking to writers because there are no writers here in Wichita really to talk to.
Well, there are talent agencies, I guess, in Wichita because my agent just called me and is sending me out for a print ad for a gig that shoots in Wichita. So maybe where you're liking writers, you have some advertising happening, it seems. Intrust Banks?
Oh yeah,
Intrust Bank. I don't know. It's weird. I'm kind of throwing my hat back in the ring in the agency world after having not done the agency world since I had hair in my 20s. You know, so now that I am in my early 40s, my type has changed. So now I get to I'm in consideration for doctors and dads and teachers and bankers and that whole kind of thing. So we'll see how that works out.
Well, if you get it and you end up coming down here to Wichita, if you spend more than a few hours, give me a call. We'll go out for a drink.
Okay. I would. Yeah, I'd love that. What's the place? The Crown, the Anchor, the Crown Anchor. Yeah. Oh, just the Anchor. Okay. Yeah. I love that place. That place feels like a Kansas City bar, you know?
It's owned by a friend of mine from high school. Yeah, that place is owned by a friend of mine from high school. So every now and then I'll get to see her when I go in there, but it doesn't get me anything. So
I was going to say, shit, that'll give us the hookup. You know, shots on you and the high school friend. So I don't know. That's what I've been thinking about. I've been doing this NaNoWriMo. This is my first year with. Well, it's going good. You know, where are we? We're at the 23rd. Oh, shit. 7 more days. Woo! it sneaks up on you. You know, yeah. I never done it before, and I decided I'm writing my first book, and that's really crazy because I became a monthly columnist for a couple of different magazines over the in the last decade, and I kind of realized that after doing a one-man show a couple of years ago that really I kind of went from the page to the stage back to the page. Mm-hmm. And it's been a real interesting process. And so I wanted the structure and kind of the encouragement of NaNoWriMo. And I'm type A enough that, you know, I like to finish my homework assignments. I like to excel. So I wanted, you know, I'm like 50,000 words. I can do this. I've got this. So I took the verbiage from my show, which ended up being about maybe 11,000 words. Uh-huh. And I just kind of plugged that in and I decided I was going to build around it and work to make it a literary memoir.
Which show, Jolly Rancher? Yeah. Or
Jolly Rancher, which is what do you call a gay farmer? A Jolly Rancher.
Right.
it's a memoir that really kind of spans from even before me, generations of farmers before me, kind of setting up the scene, and then it goes into becoming the pink sheep of the family, and kind of it's a coming of age tale. It's a coming out story, which I say that with a bit of a breath because I know that it's kind of a tiresome thing, but I guarantee it's more. You know, I think it's a unique experience that hasn't really hit our culture. You know, the experience of a gay farmer, and I think in some ways, that idea presents itself that really gay is nature rather than nurture. You know, I wasn't around anybody except for combines and soybeans and cattle. And so, but you know, it was very, you know, I've been looking back at like old pictures and I am working some poses and some pictures, you know, I mean, there's just something implicitly gay about this little kid who's popping his knee and he's got his arms akimbo in front of the combine out in the middle of the field. You know, where did I, where do you learn that? And if no one taught this to me, then there must be others like me.
Right.
You know? Go ahead.
Oh, well, that's kind of where I was wanting to go. I mean, you do a lot of writing in kind of the autobiographical vein. I mean, Jolly Rancher is, you know, from what I've read, is taken a lot from, well, you say yourself, you write creative nonfiction, so you're pulling a lot on your own life. And so I was wanting to get you to talk about that a little bit, about Lewisburg in particular and what it was like growing up and where do you – I mean, yes, it's obvious from some of the pictures that there's this innate kind of, what do you
call
it?
Gaiety.
And, yeah. But you know, there's, I feel that it's the same kind of innate writerliness pops up from the beginning. So, I mean, besides from performing, and you have some great stories about performing for the farmhands, but did you write at that time as well? I mean, was there that urge to just create and do, and how did your family cope with that?
How did they cope with it? Well, okay, that's a lot of questions. Let me go back a little bit. It was always very natural to me to want to be in front of people and talking to people and performing. And, you know, I loved stepping outside of myself. You know, I was so sequestered away. Our nearest neighbors lived miles away. And so my world was, you know, I had an older brother and an older sister that, half brother and half sister that lived with their mom part-time. And so they're 7 and 9 years older than me. Yeah. So I was really kind of really raised for quite a while as an only child. And so I had a very egocentric view of the world because it really did kind of rotate around me. There were all these older people and, you know, I was always just kind of the center of attention. And so I, you know, when given the spotlight, you just tend to perform. And so then that just kind of moved me in that direction, you know, performing at family reunions or performing, as you said, for the Hay Crew. that was always very natural to me. And it just felt like something that I wanted to do, and I felt a responsibility to do it.
Responsibility? A responsibility?
I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, no one else is performing. And so I kind of took it on myself as that this is my role. This is what people have come to expect. I mean, they remember my dance from last harvest. So I better up my game and bring a new, you know, this year I'm going to play the fiddle for you. How do y'all like that? You know, and they clap and I'm like, dang. It's hilarious because it's true, you know? Yeah. And so I guess it kind of extended out of that. And, you know, then I went to college, as you know, and I guess we should probably give full disclosure that we were roommates briefly and as a K-State.
21 years ago.
Isn't that crazy? I just went up there for the 20th year with an old three lesbians that I lived with in college. They all played on the rugby team and kind of protected me, and I love that. Anyway, we met up just I guess the end of September at K-State, and I hadn't been up there since, oh god, I mean, maybe 1996. No, 2003. It had been 10 years. So that was pretty crazy. So I guess going back to in college, when we were roommates, I was all about getting cast in the theater and really wanted to do that. And, you know, and then I just did that. And so I came to Kansas City and got involved in a theater company called Late Night Theater, and we became very popular, kind of a cult, developed a cult following here in Kansas City. And then I had a couple of things fall in my lap where I went to a Pride event, and there was a local gay newspaper that was handing out surveys. And if you filled out the survey, I think you got a Miller Lite or something. And so, well, hell no. I mean, hell, you know, of course I'm going to, you know, fill it out. I want a cold Miller Lite. So I fill out the survey, and toward the end of it, it says, would you be interested in writing for the Liberty Press? Uh-huh. And so I said, sure. And then it said, if so, what would you like to write about? And, you know, I was just a cocky little shit. And so I said, I'd like to write a column about being a socialite in Kansas City. Right. And so I just kind of didn't think anything more about it. And then they called me not too long thereafter and offered me a monthly column. Now, I didn't get paid, but at that point it was also new to me that I just decided to do it. And every month I submitted an 800 to 1,000 word story. And it kind of took off. You know, I got mixed reviews. You know, 1 month, someone sent in a letter, said, David Wayne Reed is disgusting, and it's, you know, humor, and nobody cares about his shortcomings, and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, thank you very much. Well, just the next month, you know, there's someone else who's like, ah, witty, brilliant, hilarious. I'd like to see this guy online so I can let my friends get a taste of his razor sharp and dead on wit. Okay, well, you know, it's like at that point I realized that I was doing something right. That, yeah, you know, people, it was a lightning rod, and it was starting a conversation, and it kind of gave me this. It gave me a platform, and it also gave me a power, and it gave me a real confidence in what I had to say, because obviously people were reacting to it, and it was starting dialogues that maybe should occur. And so I did that, and then I kind of got back to writing plays, and read a lot of plays and produced those. And then the theater company that I had helped start, we decided to end after 10 years. And I really kind of lost a sense of identity. You know, when you, I think we find so much identity in our work that when we're not working, it's jarring, and we don't know our place. And so I really kind of lost that. Since I was no longer a part of late night theater, I couldn't wear that as a badge any longer. And I wasn't writing. And so that was a kind of a darker time, kind of figuring that out, who we are when we're not really attached to something, and learning the lesson that, you know, you're still somebody without those attachments.
What year was that?
That would have probably been 2006, end of six. And then, fortunately, a good friend of mine started working as an editor for KC Magazine and recommended me to become a monthly columnist. They were looking for a columnist, and I had probably about a year and a half of experience from writing for the Liberty Press. And so I submitted a couple of stories, and they loved it, and they gave me a monthly column.
And did they pay you?
Yes. I was paid monthly, and I thought, wow, this is living. And so that year I just started buying myself every electronic gadget I could find, and because I knew I'd have to write it off, you know, write it off at the end of the year. And so I bought a lot of copy paper that year, you know, a laptop, a printer, a scanner, all that stuff.
Are you lucky enough that that's your full-time job, or do you have a mortal day job?
I have a mortal day job, and I've kept a mortal day job for a really long time, because I'm one of those people, I can't just throw, I have thrown myself out into, you know, treading the boards, and I hate it. It makes me crazy. I need to know where I have a source of money. I need to know that I have health insurance. I need to know, I need to have those reassurances. And I don't know if that's because I'm 41 or if that's just because I finally learned after continually going and putting my hand on that hot iron and burning myself and going in debt and being desperate and having to sell CDs and clothes so I could eat, you know, and those, like, those desperate choices that artists are often forced to make. And I have a real job, a day job, my 40-hour week job, and I've had that. I just celebrated my 8-year anniversary, which is just batshit crazy to me to think about.
You're dependable now.
I'm dependable. I'm bordering on mature. And you know what? I did a story. I did a reading at a friend's radio show the other day, and someone said, "Oh, that was a real departure for you. It wasn't funny." And I said, "I know. I think in my 40s, I've gotten very, very serious. Very, very serious. I used to be hilarious, but I think I've left that behind me now." It
makes sense. I mean, there's a time, I guess, in life to be, you know, raucous, frivolous, whatever, and then you reach a certain point. I know I've felt it a lot lately, is, you know, you start looking at, I think it's an age thing. I mean, I've become incredibly aware lately that because of my situation, because of debt, because of decisions I've made, that there are probably things in my life that I just am never going to do. And when I was younger, I thought, oh yeah, I have time to do that. And it's like, not anymore. And that sobers you up pretty quick. I think you whittle down to what's really, really important. And that's why I've shaved off a lot of goofy stuff I was doing and focused on writing and, you know, doing the podcast and trying to make myself comfortable in my life so that I don't get to the end of it and be like, man, I'm disappointed with everything. Mm-hmm. I have to shed those overblown dreams for something that's more attainable. That sounds sad, doesn't it?
Well, no, I think that is a real sign of maturity that, you know, I think that as young people, we believe that in that kind of lottery system that, mm-hmm. you know, one of these days we're just going to be discovered and we're going to blow up. And, you know, you sacrifice so much in terms of this lottery and you put yourself, I think as young people, we have this idea that it's just like, pick me, somebody, please pick me. And we're so desperate. And that's what I learned from, you know, God, auditioning and being an actor. I mean, we just throw ourselves out there at people's mercy and just hoping that they'll give us a shot. Well, a lot of times you don't get the shot. So you got to create your own shots. And that, you know, when I realized that really changed everything. I was very good at like accepting and catching on to vines of opportunity that would swing my way. But what I didn't realize was I wasn't good at setting them up in front of me, kind of building a line of vines to swing one by one from two.
That really
changed things. And it also made me realize that, you know, you've got to have a plan. You got to start at the end and work backwards to develop your plan. And then once you've developed that map for yourself, then it makes it easier to guide you on your journey. And I don't think, you know, I think a lot of times people just think, well, whatever happens to me, happens to me. Mm-hmm. As if, you know, you have no, you have no right, and you are not
no authority of your
creating
own.
your own life. Like it's just whatever. I just walked into this wall. Oops. Oh well. You know, that's bound to happen to me. I'm always clumsy. I'm always walking. Boop. I walked into another wall. You know, we don't have to be that way. You know, we've just got to figure out our own maps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Been tough though. You know. There's a comfort in the dreams of youth, and it's tough to get rid of. It's tough to let go of when you reach our age, I think. Not that we're incredibly old, I mean, but...
Oh, right. Man. I mean, we're, you know, I complain about how my knee hurts, like, because the, you know, the cold, we're in a cold snap right now. It's like, I don't know, 8-10 degrees outside now, I think. So stupid. But, you know, my knee has been hurting this week. It's like, I feel like my bad knee, my age indicates weather patterns now. It's kind of like being cattle group in the corner of a lot. It means that there's a rain coming, you know, it's just kind of those things. But we're not, 40 is still, even though we have those kind of things, I'm still reminded that I'm 40. I have a long time to go. You know, earlier this year, I met a woman at my aunt's nursing home, and she was literally 113.
Wow, really?
And she was just as lucid as anything. And she was well-dressed, and not 113, I'm sorry, 103, but still.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she was just as together as anything. And I had a really wonderful conversation with her. Her name's Margaret Sennamore. And I realized at that moment, she was our age in 1950. You want to give yourself some perspective. Think about that, right, and think about all the things that have happened in those years. And it's just like, I see so many people who are like, God, I just can't wait to retire when I'm 45 or, you know, whatnot. And it's like, I don't even want that. I don't, I just want to keep going, because how am I going to fill my time? How am I going to, to 103? And that really is possible for our generation.
Oh, yeah.
Even though our healthcare system sucks, we do have more advances in healthcare so that we can live feasibly that long.
Oh, yeah. And who knows, between they've mapped the human genome, they've got 3D printers now that can print everything from organ tissue to handguns. So, we've got replacement body parts online. So,
make them designer,
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
So you started writing with the column with Liberty Press. Had you written like that before? Had you been like on the high school newspaper? It just comp you had?
But that was it. was it, Jason. It's so funny. I was part of journalism in high school, and also I did forensics and debate, where I'd written, my own material. And then I went to college and I started off in journalism, and it just wasn't working out. I think I got a C. I think I got a C in my class. And in high school, I'd won like the Kansas, they had that big journalism competition for high schoolers in Lawrence every year. And I won first place in feature writing that year. And it was like, whoa, so unexpected. And so I'm feeling pretty good about it. But then I just let it go once I started to not do so well at K-State. And I never took a creative writing class. I mean, I've done writing workshops since then. But prior to that, never. I mean, it was really just trial by fire, and it's almost unfair because so many people they take all the classes and they do all that, and I'm that asshole that just had these opportunities just thrown in my lap. And but that's its own challenge. I mean, it's really nice to get those opportunities, but then once you're given them, you're given a platform, but that's a high platform that you're also given the opportunity to crucify yourself on.
Well, true. There's always that.
No,
it was interesting. You talked about how when you first ended up with that column and you had these polar opposite reactions and that sudden realization that writing had power. I had that happened to me when I was a columnist for my high school paper. I mean, I started writing stories in the sixth grade when a teacher handed out these worksheets where they would have fragments of a story and you'd have to finish it or write the beginning to it or stuff like that. And that's kind of when that was the thing that locked me in. Before that, I was kind of a habitual liar. I wasn't much for performing. I once thought I was going to be a performer. And I remember this one night, my parents had friends over, they would have friends over and play cards, late into the night, and I'd fall asleep on the living room floor. But I decided at one point that I was going to be a singer. And there was this whole thing where I had my dad holding up this flashlight and I was going to physically come out of the closet, with my fake microphone and do a song. And I remember as soon as I opened the door, I froze. I kind of knew at that moment that I was never going to really be a performer, although I did try theater in high school. And that was okay because there were other people around me. But being that one person on stage with the proverbial spotlight right there on you, I froze. It was never going to happen. But yeah, I hit my stride when I found, that column in high school and that was kind of, I decided that was it. That was what I was going to do. And when I went off to college, it was English creative writing, and that was it. I wasn't going to fart around.
Well, no, you didn't. You were writing all the time. And, you know, I really admired that as much as I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the discipline about it, because at that time, you know, other people wrote words for me and I interpreted them. You know, so I didn't know. I would write in my journal. You know, I kept a journal during that time off and on, pretty lazily. But yeah, I remember admiring your daily discipline.
To tell you the truth, back then, I didn't really have that much discipline. If you thought I was writing a lot from my perspective, I wasn't writing enough. I was kind of just waiting for inspiration to hit. And by the time I graduated, I had burned out. I wasn't I wasn't writing on a daily basis, and I spent 2 years not writing anything at all and drinking a lot.
I've done that too. I hear that. Well, what's your daily discipline now? What is your discipline now?
Every morning at 5 or 5:30, I get up and I write until about 7 o'clock, and then I take a shower and go to my day job.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I managed to write the first novel that way, and the second one's proven a whole lot harder. But, you know, the vagaries of going with small presses as opposed to a giant contract and selling the film rights and being able to pull a Jonathan Franzen, and that's kind of rare and freaky. You know?
I know. I mean, don't you want that? I want to be Cheryl Strayed right now. I'm really loving Cheryl Strayed's life.
Not David really Sedaris.
I love David. Well, you know, he is a real inspiration for me. You know, I love his stories. I love how he talks about his family. It really kind of emboldened me to, and inspired me to kind of take that form. You know,
right.
And of course him, Augustine Burroughs, Sarah Vowell. And Anne Lamott, I really love Anne Lamott too. And in the way that they just take these very personal moments about him and are able to expand the scope of very personal moments to include really universal themes and lessons. And I love that. Those are our modern fables, and it's like the selfie as fable. And I really dig that, and I'm really inspired by that. It really encouraged me to follow my own voice.
Well, it takes there's a special talent in that I don't think I have. I mean, to be able to take your own life and to actually, you know, make it interesting and entertaining and also have some significance and some meaning, that's a real talent, and I think you've got it. That's fabulous.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. I was trying to think real fast. Well, oh my God, how do I answer that? How do I answer who's throwing down? And I think that what I attribute that success to is really fucking up and making some really poor choices for myself at times and falling down and having to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and get context and get real with my life and see myself both as a real fallible human being with a lot of frailties and inadequacies, and also the strength to own up to them and then do the self-help work to move on and gain that perspective. It's like, if you're going to fuck up big. And if you're going to do that, say your apologies and dust yourself off and recreate and move on. You know, that's the formula. And that's also what creates fables. That's how I think, you know, and just making a lot of big choices. And putting myself in weird and bad, sometimes bad situations. you know, I love that movie. What is it? Yes Man? With, is it Jim Carrey, where he just says yes to everything and it finally gets him into trouble. But for a while, it's like, I'm just going to say yes. I'm just going to be in that moment. And, you know, I did that. I took a lot of opportunities just for the experience out of it.
Right, right.
Well,
that's the thing I do.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, writing fiction terrifies me. I don't know what to do with that. I don't even know what, I can't even imagine myself sitting down to write fiction, and if so, what it would be. I have no idea. Well, I often think that I should do, like, I should challenge myself and write, like, and to write something that's so far out of your comfort zone that you know nothing about. Like, me writing erotica, I think would just be so hilarious and so ridiculous. That something cool might, there might be something come out of that, you know, that I just, that would help me inform the creative nonfiction that I'm more comfortable writing.
Oh, definitely push yourself outside of that comfort zone. I mean, you know, if there's the, that old writing adage, you know, if you're not scared, then you're not doing it right. You know? So how long was it between the time when you started writing the column that – now, you got a theater fellowship and went down to Florida, and that's where you wrote Jolly Rancher, right?
Yes.
How did that happen?
How did that happen? I'd had some really terrible, cold, miserable winters, the winters of 2009 and 2010. Uh-huh. And I decided that – if I didn't get some sunshine and get the hell out of Dodge, I was probably going to throw myself off a building.
Right.
Not seriously, but you know, I get really manic in the winter, and it was just kind of a terrible time. And so I just needed the sunshine. That's why I applied. I had some friends who had done it before. And I'm like, well, I'll be down. I'm going to go to Florida too. And I had just started rehearsals for my play, Mother Trucker 2, Ride On. Uh-huh. And we were in rehearsals and, you know, in like from 6 until 10 every night.
Wow.
And I remember the application was due during that time at 11 o'clock. And I just did it during my day job, you know, kind of under wraps. And threw together this application and a little sampler of stories that I'd written. And actually, they came to the final show of Mother Trucker 2 and let me know that I was accepted. And which made me cry because I was so stressed out at that time. It's like when you get good news, like, and so that was really wonderful. So I found out in August, but I couldn't really come out with it until I quit it with my job to take a leave of absence.
Right.
And which I'm so glad they did. I kind of jumped through several hoops for that to happen, but regardless, it happened and I'm grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down there and I quickly found out that what I had applied for was to work on a collection of short stories, just a little collection of a few short stories. I mean, how much can you write in a month? I mean, I guess 50,000 words for NaNoWriMo.
Right.
But so on their website, I got a Google alert on myself the day that I arrived there saying, it was announcing my show in Seaside, and it said, Dingling Reed brings his one-man show to the Seaside Repertory Theater January 19th, 2012. And I am about to shit my pants because I don't know anybody down there. Nobody.
Right.
And most of them are all like these really affluent types who have their first, second, third, fourth homes there.
Right.
And, you know, rich white people. I don't know those people. Or let alone that I'm doing a one man show. Well, I arrived there on January 3rd and my show's January 19th. Oh my God.
Wow.
So I decide to, since nobody knows me, I'm going to have to introduce myself. And so I pull together like 12 of my favorite stories that I've ever written. You know, I just went back over the years of different columns I'd written, and I probably had about 36 to 40 stories to choose from. And even looking at old diary entries and, you know, how can I piece together a life so I could show these people and introduce myself to this community who does not know me. And so I decided to come up with Jolly Rancher. It's the name of a story, one of my first stories that I ever wrote for Liberty Press, and started piecing it together, and it just kind of took on its own thing. And I remember I spent so much time just editing. It's all just editing, isn't it?
Yeah,
I realized how much time I would spend with that.
The rough draft is easy. The editing is where the actual creativity comes in, because then you get to shape it and mold it, and you can hit those beats. You know, that's the best part of it. That's what I like best is revision.
I do too. I do too, but it is its own unique bitch. You know, but once I edit, I feel like I've slayed the beast. Yeah. Well, and so that's how that happened, and it ended up being like about almost a 2 hour long show.
Wow!
And I didn't, and people laughed like it was they were on a studio audience, you know, and which made it a 2 hour show because you wouldn't shut up.
Right. Now, is that the audio recordings on that I listened to?
Yes,
those are from the Florida show.
Actually, those are from the Kansas City show. Once I brought it back, but it also made people really cry. I mean, people really identified with it. And, you know, I had people who came up and they'd have tears in their eyes and they'd want to hug me, and you know, they'd say things like "Thank you for sharing my story for me." And I didn't even know that was going to happen. I was just blown away by, you know, how just sharing my own personal story, people had these amazing visceral reactions to it I was so overcome by. I just didn't see that coming 18 miles away. And so then, and this was like, I should say my audience in Florida, basically I would say the median age of that sold out audience was probably 67.
Right.
That's the median age. So white, rich septuagenarians, I have never once considered my demographic. Never once. And there they were. And they ate it up. And so then I came back, and I had to get back into the swing of work. And then a friend of mine asked me to do it at the Fish Tank Performance Studio downtown here in KC. And I found out that the theater critic was coming to see it. And I'm like, I don't think this is a theatrical piece. I don't know. You know, I'm just kind of sharing what I should, because I really kind of did it David Sedaris / what's his name? Spalding Gray style, you know, from a podium, and here's my work.
Right.
And so the theater critic came, and I didn't know how it was going to go. And then he ended up really, really loving the show.
Yeah.
And I realized I had something, you know, it wasn't just like a lucky break in Florida, and those people were maybe just so desperate for entertainment that they just clap at anything. I didn't know, but those are the thoughts that go through your mind. Like, maybe I'm just getting lucky here. And then I got back to Kansas City, and I was only set to do 3 shows. I ended up adding 3 more shows and sold all of those out. And then I did it another time last December, just because the space opened up and I could make some money. So I decided to do it. And again, it went over really well. And then I kind of stalled out, and I realized that there's so much more to the story. And it was kind of at that point that I realized this isn't a stage show. This is a book. And and I've never written a book. So I need to really back up from this and gain some perspective. And like what I was saying earlier about, you know, gaining the self-awareness so you can tell these stories. When it's about you, you have to, you kind of have to get to a place of healing before you can write about the broken times. Because if you go back and you try to get into those broken times while you're still a little feeble, it can really wreck, it can really wreck you. And there are some real significant parts of the larger story of the one-man show that I didn't really dive into, that I really needed to, had to really think about how I wanted to approach them and how I wanted to, how I wanted to write those things. And also just give myself some distance, because you don't only, you're not just you anymore. You are the hero in your own journey of this, of this story. And it's really interesting how you learn to look at yourself very objectively, because you have to, and you have to look at other people very objectively too, and not be, not be wicked for wicked's sake, not be retaliatory. You know, you have to, because if you ever write creative nonfiction out of revenge, it's going to fail.
It just becomes
angry, and nobody wants to see that. They don't even want to see it when it's on Jerry Springer. They don't want to continue to read about someone who's maladjusted. I mean, we read a book because we want to heal. We want to go on a journey. We want to learn something more about ourselves.
Right. It's strange how powerful honesty and empathy is. You wouldn't, you know, the way a lot of stuff is in society right now, you would think that honesty and empathy, oh, that's passé, that's gauche. No, it, it matters, and people don't often – I think
it's a dwindling, it's a dwindling commodity, because we think we do it. We think we do it when we overshare or share on Facebook or in status updates, but Facebook and social media creates a condom between us, and we can never really have an authentic, we can never really have an authentic moment where we really share a risk. Now, I'm not saying don't use condoms, but you know, I'm saying, you know, there's that veneer between
you're saying don't use emotional condoms.
I'm saying
don't use emotional condoms. By all means, use the latex ones, but don't use emotional
condoms. Use the latex, but not the emotional. I think we don't become, we don't know how to be authentic. We know how to be shocking and say things like, post on Facebook, oh, what's the scab on my scrotum? You know, but then, but we would never have that conversation in real life.
Right.
It becomes like it's a bit more safe, and it's not, it's removed from us. So when it's removed from us, it's not real, and it's really desensitizing.
Exactly.
And and so that's what I found like reading these stories and performing them in front of these audiences. It was really like being an emotional host. And triggering other people's memories. So together we created like this storytelling experience upon another storytelling experience. You know, as I would lead them into telling them a story, you know, I remember I mentioned like bucking hay bales in the show in Florida, and this older man from New Orleans, you know, this real thick accent, I think his name was Buzz, right? You know, I mean, it's just so classic. He really identified with bucking hay bales, and it reminded him of the story of arguing with these African-American farmhands that he worked with, whether or not Elvis Presley was really black or white, because they didn't know, they didn't have TVs. But that's what they, that led him into that memory while they were bucking hay bales. And another girl, you know, talked about, I mentioned making these angels to sell in this craft store out of raffia, and it took her to this place with her mom. And it's just really interesting how you kind of plant these seeds and people just kind of take off from that, and they create their own stories. And then the room fills with that, and the room fills with tears and laughter and shared experience. And I think therefore it's empathy. it's community. And so, I don't know, that was a new experience for me because, you know, in doing theater, you always put that kind of emotional condom up between you and the audience. Right. There's always that fourth wall. And this, you know, it took the elements of theater and characterization and storytelling, but it flipped it on its head. It became theater of the personal.
Yeah.
And, and so that's where I was like, oh, well, if this is working here, this is really a book, and this can go other places. So anyway, that's what I'm doing.
And that's what you're jump starting with NaNoWriMo, is expanding this and pulling and tugging it open.
Yes. I started with the 11,000 words that comprised the show. And I just put those in there, and then I decided I would go in and see where, and write between the lines, you know, take deeper dives on each of the stories. And the way you perform it for stage and the way that it's read are two totally different styles. And so kind of building off of that, and so we're November 23rd. I have 40,000 words in altogether. So I've written 29,000 words so far this month.
That's good. So, that's good going. That's good.
I'm up to like a total of 39, whatever. I think.
So how did you get, how'd you get this piece into Midwestern Gothic, and was that solicited? Did you submit?
No, I submitted. A friend of mine, who's a grad student at UMKC, she interned for the Fish Tank Performance Studio last year, and my friend Heidi runs that space, and she had a lot of interns who were looking for things to do, more projects. And so Heidi said, "Do you have any projects?" And I said, "Well, actually, I do." And so this girl, Allie Jordan, helped me with a couple projects and recommended some literary journals. She had come to see Jolly Rancher, and she was like, "Those should be in literary journals. You need to keep the stories and market them." And so I took my favorite and I sent it into Midwestern Gothic, and
they took it.
And I got in. I mean, again, it was like, yeah, I sound like such a jerk. I never submitted. Ever before. I never submitted anything. It was really just kind of a whole new world. And then I got it. Now, you know, I didn't get paid, but just to be kind of validated, because I've really been kind of insulated in my whole experience of this.
Well, I wouldn't say that, you know, being in Kansas City is insulated. I mean,
I mean more so like insulated from the writing community.
Oh,
I'm coming from the theater. I'm from the theater community. I don't come from a background in creative writing. Uh-huh. I say that after I've written for, you know, several magazines, but I'm still always kind of reminded of, you know, my experience. Like, I don't really have the experience for this. Oh yeah, wait, I do, but I'm not a part of those communities. Like, I don't hang out with. I don't hang out with a lot of other writers, a few, but you know, that's really been recently. Like when I was writing for the magazines and all of that, I wasn't hanging out with like maybe one or two other writers, and they were journalists for the local papers.
Right.
But as far as creative writing, that's where I'm insulated, because I'm not a part of that. I've been trying to make more of an effort to get involved in like playwriting groups or go to retreats. But even then, I still have my own critique of those too. So, anyway.
Well, let's back up a little bit. And when did you come up with Mother Trucker?
I came up with Mother Trucker, the first one. There are two of them, the first and the sequel. I came up with Mother Trucker on a weekend. I literally wrote it in a weekend. That's the only time that has ever, ever happened.
Right.
Back in 2000, I think maybe in 2004. I wrote it on a spring day in 2004 and produced it that fall. Wow. And then I
Were the sets always that elaborate, or is that just in a recent production? Because I've watched some of the video of that, and those sets are amazing.
I had a really good set designer. I've got it, my old roommate and collaborator, John. He is fantastic. And I'll tell you how the set works. I drew a picture of a beautiful blue sky with puffy, beautiful clouds in the background, and this kindergarten rendering of a pink truck in the center. I always knew that it was a pink truck in the center, and it should be on a turntable. And on the back of it, I would project video. I always knew that, but that's all I knew.
Wow.
And so I basically did it in crayon, and I'm really not kidding. Crayon and graph paper, so I could follow the lines. And I gave it to him, and he totally understood. He totally knew, and he totally knew what I wanted. And I would give him just the most basic and rudimentary ideas. Uh-huh. I mean, it was really like kind of communicating the idea of what I wanted on the set by a childish drawing and charades is basically how we built that, how I communicated to the set built. So that happened. And then it's been cool because earlier this year, Seaside Repertory Theater did Mother Trucker, and they had, you know, some different, they did a pretty a pretty fair facsimile of a performance to what we had done. You know, they really stayed true to the script and the styling of it, but added a few things. And you know, their truck was really pretty. You know, I have to give it to them. It's like I've seen three of the trucks be built, two by me and the two productions I did here, and then the one down in Seaside. And it's interesting because it takes on a life outside of you, and you just, I mean, with a name like Mother Trucker, it's got to take off. It's got to drive on into new frontiers. So that was interesting too. That was a real interesting lesson in letting go.
Yeah,
for sure.
I've seen excerpts on video, and I've never been able to get up to Kansas City to see it because, you know, like you, I worry about my bills, and I haven't had a job where I had vacation time and you know, paid time off and stuff like that where I could actually, you know, leave work for a number of days and not worry about losing money. So if you stage it again, I can take time off and come see it now. But a lot of people listening here won't know the story about it when they listen to this podcast. So what is the story of Mother Trucker?
Mother Trucker is the westbound and lowdown tale of Ruby Lee Jenkins, who has just lost her husband, Jerry Lee Jenkins, in a tragic trucking accident. And she is left to take care of their boy, Teddy Bear. And I totally took this from, there's a song, Teddy Bear, about this little crippled boy whose daddy dies in a trucking accident. I literally stole this character, just like, I'm going to take this kid. Because I always thought he was really hilarious because that's such a hokey song. It's a spoken word song by Red Sovine that's just so over the top and so overwrought that it becomes camp just because he's working so hard to just, you know, make you bawl your eyes out that it becomes camp and ridiculous.
Right.
So I wanted to take that character. And so she and Teddy Bear are trying to make ends meet now that daddy's dead and gone, and they come across this this offer to run Alabama No-No Juice. So they go over to Letohatchee, Alabama to grab this hooch to bring back to Daddy's party at the Houston Astrodome. And meanwhile, while they're doing that, they meet this roadside drifter named Deke, who is hitchhiking to get out of this wedding with Sheila, who is the daughter of the sheriff guy, and so they're on a run, and it's totally Teddy Bear meets Smokey and the Bandit, kind of with some changes and making it a musical number. I mean, it really was just as simple as that.
Wow.
And so I did that. I just got curious about them. I kind of wondered what they were doing now. And I decided probably in 2010, that I wanted to bring them back. So I wrote a new I had them going to Mexico. I had this like real big story worked out. And then I had it totally outlined. And then I realized that it had a fatal error. And I had to rewrite everything. And this is after I had received an inspiration grant from the Arts Council of Kansas City to do this. And so I had money, had $1,000 to seed the production that would go to rebuild the truck for the set. And then I realized that my story outline was terrible and it wouldn't work. I painted myself into a corner and it didn't work. So I literally burned the script kind of as I don't know what I was doing. It was a spiritual manic release, kind of moment. Yeah. Some voodoo magic of releasing that. And I started all over again. And by this time, I was already leading a Kickstarter campaign to gain $3,500 more so I could pay for costumes and lights.
Right.
And so I'm writing while I made my $3,500 and, you know, everybody's all behind this and I don't have a script. And I literally, I started rehearsals with act one. I'm like, okay guys, well, here's what we have. Here's act one. Let's start reading through that and staging that. And then I delivered my, God, this makes me just sound terrible. But it's true. I delivered my final script or act two to my actors on the Sunday before we opened on Friday, July 15th of 2011. Oh my God.
That's some creativity under pressure.
Crazy. Well, during that time, I'm already a fairly thin person, and in that time, I lost 23 pounds in like a month's time. I mean, you know, it was time I was living and subsisting off of green tea, PBR, and Xanax, and occasional bags of Doritos. That was my entire diet. I don't advise that to anyone. It was terrible. But then the show got a fantastic review and so then that happened, you know. I feel like I'm coming across as just like somebody who doesn't deserve all this good luck that has been given to them. I've worked hard, but
that's crazy, David. You deserve it. It's when good luck happens because you do the hard work. I mean, if it just drops in your lap once, that's good luck, but it usually only happens that once. The reason you have continued good luck is because you do the hard work and something comes along and you're able to take advantage of it. Don't sell yourself short, man.
You're right. No, you're absolutely right. I just don't want to make it sound like it's too easy. It's just like when you do get those breaks, you're like, oh my God, really have to take some time to appreciate all the great people who have helped you along the way and those fortunate circumstances that have helped. Anyway, yeah.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about the $1,000 hot dog and that Casey Stagg cover.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll go with the Casey Stagg cover. I was approached by Casey Stage magazine to it's Casey Stage, but they wanted to do a Casey Stagg cover, and they wanted something funny, and they definitely wanted a man on the front, and they wanted a man who would consider doing nudity. And so they called me. and they pitched like doing the Burt Reynolds laying naked on a bearskin rug. And, you know, I thought, I mean, I'd do it, but it's a vertical cover, and that's a horizontal shot. And
right.
I already kind of thought it'd already been overdone, and I just wasn't that interested in it. So I suggested to kind of highlight my past with late night theater, where we often, you know, we were a company of all men, and so we played ladies' roles too. I'd kind of do a little nod to my past and you know, love of pop culture, and recreate the Janet Jackson Rolling Stone cover where someone, a guy, is reaching up behind her and cupping her breasts, and she's got her hands over her head. Well, so I did that with my drag queen friend, Dee Dee, who was in late night with me. And she put on a lot of jewelry, and, you know, her nails were all done. And so she got behind me, and we shot this in some guy's home in Overland Park, which was very weird. But she got that shot, and just thought it was just tongue-in-cheek and kind of funny. And so that was it. And they ran a real nice feature on me. And so that happened back in April.
I snorted out loud when I saw that picture. It was hilarious. It was fabulous.
Well, it's on my blog. If anybody wants to go see that, dwayneweed.blogspot.com. So
I'll put all of it in the show notes there. That was fabulous. So you've got a few more days left on NaNoWriMo, all right?
NaNoWriMo, I am currently working. Jolly Rancher's told in three parts. Mm-hmm. First part is seed, and second part is sprout, and third is harvest. That were apps with to divide up the chapters, especially for a book about a gay farmer. And so I am currently in sprout. You know, harvest has already been written. You know, mm-hmm. I always start with the end. The end is always the easiest, and it's like kind of getting back has been the hardest. I just finished the seed section, which was actually pretty hard. That goes back to some real weird stuff in high school, but now I'm working on college. I'm glad to say, Jason, that I don't have any incriminating stuff to tell about you, so that your audience might be disappointed too.
That
I probably won't have anything incriminating on the beloved host of this program. But
I don't know how many listeners I have so far, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, for all of you, thank you for joining in. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And so, NaNoWriMo, I'll finish that by the end of the, get the word count in by the end of the month, mm-hmm. and I know there'll be more words, but then really take December to edit and really massage and ship away. And,
right.
You know how that goes, all that stuff.
I'd love to read it. I'd love to help out any way you think I might be able to. It's what I like doing. I like editing and helping other writers out. So keep me in mind if you need another set of eyes or some help.
I definitely will, and I will take you. I will take you up on that. I've got a small team of friends that I was planning on sending it out to, and so I'll be glad to ask you on that, because I want to get other people. You know, it's when you're writing a book, you get so far into it that sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees, and you just need a friend to say, "Hey, this part was kind of janky. What the hell were you doing here?" Maybe, you know, what have you? So that'd be wonderful.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today, David. That was great.
Absolutely, I've had a great time, and hopefully, it won't be 20 years before we talk again.
No, it won't. I have vacation time now. We'll see each other soon.
Okay.
All right. That was my conversation with David Wayne Reed. Thanks for listening.
Be sure to come back in 2 weeks where I will have my conversation with Colin Dickey. He's the author of Craniocleptic and The Afterlives of the Saints.
Goodbye.